Welcome to BizBytes, a podcast focused on technology and business. I'm your host, Anthony McMahon. In each episode, I interview New Zealand business owners and technology leaders discussing their views on the impact technology's had on business, what it might mean for the future, and their thoughts on how to adapt to the changes ahead. If there is one thing we can bank on, it's that change is constant. And we also know that people react in different ways to change. Uncertainty, confusion, and the age-old question of what's in it for me will play a role in how each person reacts to change, which is why the messages you send around any change in your business are important. You need to respect boundaries and be aware that the things that we say, and sometimes those that we don't, will matter. And also keep in mind that it's never the big things that catch us out. It's often the small parts of the message, and if we get them wrong, it's very hard to walk them back. So how do we get the messaging right about change, especially when trying to deal with competing outcomes? Focusing on the outcomes we're trying to achieve is a critical step. Eliminating jargon is also important. You must keep the message clear, concise, and void of any confusion. But what does a scarf have to do with change? My guest today is a good friend and former colleague, Christy Law. Once upon a time, Christy wanted to be an astronaut. And like Apollo 13, she knows that in change, it's not the big things you need to watch out for, but the little things. Or the things that seem little that turn into the big surprises. An experienced change leader, Christy is a go-to for her pragmatic approach and her passion for building the next generation of changelings. In today's episode, we discuss good approaches to great change. Welcome, Christy, and great to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. This is definitely a nice way to chat.
Absolutely. We're recording at the end of the week on a Friday as well, so it's a good way to wind down, just having a great conversation with an old colleague, with an old friend.
It is, although I must say if we were together in person, there would probably be a couple of beers in front of us. We really should have thought about this earlier.
We should have, but we're still in that isolation period, and you're in Wellington, I'm in Auckland. We can't, it would have been too hard to do that, so we'll have to defer that to next time.
Good thinking.
Look, we're gonna start with a very big question on this one, and it relates to current events. So, your experience with change management and with working through change, you've got a lot of experience in working through change and uncertainty. But this is probably quite a volatile and uncertain point we've been in. So, how would you compare the way you've seen things going and the way you've been able to manage events over the last 2 to 3 months? With how would you contrast that with normal times?
So that it's a really good question, because I think there was a really entertaining wee thing. I think it was on BuzzFeed of all places a couple of months ago, and it was a parody of a girl talking to herself. So a girl from, you know, January of this year, talking to herself mid lockdown, giving advice. You know, things like you know investing in places like Zoom, and you know, the girl of the past talking about how the fires in Australia would be the pivotal event of 2020, and the girl of the future saying, Oh yeah, those things. So I think if there's anything that our current situation is talking us about, we're in a period of uncertainty that certainly in modern history we haven't really dealt with. But at the same time, humans are humans. We react in similar ways. I feel in our current situation we're probably reacting for longer because we get different surprises every day. But we're still humans, and fundamentally we can all still go back to some of those core change tools to help us work through things.
And It's a good point there with the tools as well. I know the video you're talking about, I thought it was fantastic and a very clever one. But yep. the tools that you bring into, or anyone would bring into a situation of change, and I'm using the term change quite broadly now, what kind of tools work? What are the tools that you've seen be most effective in those situations?
Yeah, so it's been really interesting because I found myself going back, of all things, to David Brock's SCARF model. And so for anyone who hasn't heard of the SCARF model before, it's based on neuroscience research, and it looks at five social domains. It's got status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. And it's more about when you look at this model, it takes us back to our primitive brain. And if I think about COVID-19 and the way that we're responding, it's at that very raw and visceral level. So it's basically been quite a cool one to pull out and say, okay, cool, right now, the big thing for me is certainty. We can't predict the future. And that's really uncomfortable when we're in an era of big data, in an era where we're always thinking about what's ahead and how do we plan for it and what's coming our way. We don't have that normal lens of reference that we have. As much as we can go back to the Great Plague and events of the past, or in my case, sit down and watch a few series of Handmaid's Tale and go, oh, yeah, Margaret Atwood there. we don't have that point of reference that I think we've had in other change situations that haven't been of our own making. So things like earthquakes, because we've been through those. This is wholly different. So I've been using that quite a bit just to check through and say, why are my people reacting this way? Or why are those around me acting in this way? What's it coming back to? And that sense of certainty and also that sense of autonomy, which is our control over events, those are things that really get us pinging and going, oh, I don't feel safe. I don't feel comfortable. This is something that, you know, I'm really going to go back into that primitive response mode and think and react accordingly.
Absolutely. And you raise an interesting point there with earthquake versus, or the way we've reacted to an earthquake versus how we are today. If I think to New Zealand's had a bit of experience with earthquakes over the last few years, I think that at a national level, it's been hard to judge the impact of some of those, because an earthquake in Christchurch, mm-hmm. an earthquake in Wellington, very disruptive for the people there. Auckland, Dunedin, other parts of the country, not so disruptive. But even then, within those communities, you know, the damage and destruction in Christchurch was isolated to certain elements of the city and not to others. So suddenly you get these stories mm-hmm. of people who were massively impacted on the day, got home was still standing, water was not running, but that got turned on pretty quickly. Everything was fine for them, versus people who got home and their house was destroyed and they had nowhere to go. You know, so at that point, an earthquake's a good example where throughout the change, not everyone's experiencing it in the same way. But with COVID-19, we all experienced it in the same way. We all got impacted. We got told, go home, stay home, save lives. Everyone. There was no exception. Yeah. Right? So it is different, isn't it?
And you know what? It's really one of the things I always talk about. So like thinking about change broadly, there are principles people always tend to go back to, particularly people who are just starting to learn about change. So you tend to see people referring to the Procyon model or the Cotton model. And one of the things I've always said when anyone talks about Cotton to me in New Zealanders are non-hierarchical. We don't really like rules. We're about the number 8-1 mentality. But if someone's standing over us saying thou shalt, we're not the nation that really responds well to that. But to tell you what, level 4 lockdown really, really challenges that assumption for us, because this is one of those times where we actually had to stay home and had to follow the rules. And I confess, my change brain was going, how is this going to play out? You know, we're not good at that. And yet, because of the threat, because of what we were seeing overseas, and more importantly, because of the way it was communicated in such a swift way, we did. So that does throw you a little bit off your change axis when you're going, oh, the things I normally would do aren't quite playing out. And again, that's where we're back to, how do people primitively respond? What's the way that we're going to behave? And how do we just react at our core? Because in these instances, that's what you're looking at first and foremost. There isn't sort of that there's a phrase some of my teammates like to use in the office. We sometimes talk about change as a paint by numbers thing, which is it's not a great phrase to use, but sometimes it's those standard types of change, you know, your technology changes, your compliance changes, which are a bit formulaic, and you know that your tried and tested approach will work. We've got to throw that out the window. So it's been a really, really interesting learning curve, I guess.
I agree. I think the learning curve has been significant for everyone. And you talked about some of those models. One that I was exploring a little bit at the start was Tuckman's model, which is the storming, norming, creation of a team.
Storming, norming, performing, yeah.
and there was evidence of each of those happening, but it wasn't in that linear view that Tuckman presented. You know, storming kind of happened all the way through. Morning was happening all the way through. The other one I heard talked about, which I didn't really look into, was the Kubler-Ross stages of grief.
Stages of grief.
And I think we definitely saw that denial, acceptance. Some people jumped pretty quickly to acceptance, and some people still stayed early on in anger and denial for a significant part of it. So again, everyone's acting differently, aren't they?
The other one as well that's been quite interesting is looking at the change innovation or adoption curve where you've got your early adopters and you know it's a technology curve but we've adapted it for so many things now. You've got your early adopters and you've got your laggards at the end. And I think what's been most fascinating to me is you know people who were really really resistant to the notion of going into level four lockdown of working from home you know not feeling they could do their jobs those who were in the privileged position to have roles and now as we're you know preparing to see the announcement about level one they're these same people who have a real sense of anxiety about coming back into something that previously they were so reluctant to let go of again it tests so many of so many people's assumptions in terms of how they work and how they interact, and it's just interesting watching that behavior. I can change mood out over this for hours, though, as you can probably guess.
And I've noticed something interesting in some of the social groups that I just see online, where 8 weeks ago the feeling that level four was too restrictive and outrage and anger, those same people in the last week within New Zealand where we had the protests for across Auckland and Wellington for the civil rights movement in America. Those same people that were angry about level four are now angry about people getting too close together in level two. And I'm like, you guys are just never going to be happy. You're always angry, regardless of what the message is. You just need to be outraged by something.
But I think this is where I bring it back to. Humans are humans, first and foremost. We're not robots. And that's why we have so many different models and approaches and theories and schools of thought about how we act and change, because we're not robots. I always say that you know, the second that they work out how to bring AI into change management, absolutely that, you know, I'll be out of a role. At the same time, I go, I'm really curious to see what that would look like because we're not robots. Some things you can predict. So, for example, your point, getting angry about something, you can definitely predict that, for example. But the question there is, but what is it going to, what's the thing going to be that tips people off? Or what's the thing that people are going to react against?
Bringing it back into the conversation on change, because we try and stay away from too much politics in these conversations, because you can, it's the simple things, and politics can go down dark places. But bringing it back to change, you talked about barriers to change before. What are and we have probably we've danced around a few of them already, I think. But what are some of the most significant barriers to change that you see, or that you've encountered?
So I think so. It depends on if you're talking about this at an organizational or at a group level, or if you're talking about it at an individual level. And ultimately, if you're talking about group change, you should always think about where are the individuals first. And you know, there's the 5-step model from Prosa around individual change, the ADKAR model, which you know a lot of people tend to be familiar with. And there's those 5 stages of change that are linear: it's awareness, desire, knowledge. Gosh, my goodness, you can tell that it's late on a Friday. I'm having a moment. Ability and reinforcement. Goodness me. And one of the big barriers to change is actually a lack of awareness. So if people don't under, you know, don't actually have that information of the need to change, you know, up front, what is this? Then they're not going to want such change, and that immediately gets us into desire as well. Do we have a desire to change, or a desire to avoid the consequences of not changing? And if, again, if you come back into COVID-19, because it's just such a handy example to use. You go back to November, December last year, there was a little bit of awareness we were starting to see. I still remember my first email in the office about COVID-19, and it was actually titled, I think it was Novel Coronavirus or something at the time, whatever name we were using then. But I still remember that first email, which would have been about July, and it was more just a heads up, you know, World Health Organization are saying these things, just need to be mindful. That was just that's that first piece of awareness. And at the time, I was going, okay, yep, heard a couple of things in China. I probably need to know about it. But that desire piece didn't really start to kick in until we saw headlines overseas of what was happening in hospitals, until we were sort of seeing the reports out of China and then you know getting into Italy and into Spain. And then more locally, as we were talking about lockdown levels, what those consequences would be if we didn't all actually step into line and adhere to those lockdown requirements. So those are, I always come back to, where are we here? And then you move on to knowledge. So do people actually have the knowledge to enable them to change? So publishing those alert levels, and particularly alert level 4, what you could do, what you couldn't do. If those communications hadn't been clear, if we hadn't given people that knowledge on what they needed to do and how they needed to behave differently, then how could they change? You have to have that knowledge there. And then you get into ability and reinforcement. Ability is about putting that knowledge into practical action. So if you think about those first, you know, that's sort of 48 hours before we went into level 4 lockdown, so much of that was actually trying to work out, so how do I apply this knowledge? What are the things I need to do? What are the things I'm going to do before I go into lockdown so I can follow those rules, such as I'll go to the supermarket and go nuts in the toilet paper aisle, but it's that ability stuff. And then the last piece is that reinforcement. If we're not reinforcing those behaviours, then why would you stick with the change? It's stickability. So rather than focusing on barriers to change, I'd bring it back to what individual steps do we need to make in order to be able to change effectively? And I think that's a helpful way of looking at it, because then we can go, there's tangible action at each of those stages, whereas if you start getting into barriers, and look, we can find them, and you can also go through where those barriers to adopt and change are, but it really is about, what am I doing first and foremost to enable people? That's just my approach. To be fair, I like to look at where are the good things that we can leverage in on, and how can we, you know, it's strength finders mentality. It's how do we actually amplify the things that people are good at, rather than going, this person's not changing, they're a resistor. That's just, you know, sometimes you really actually focus on how we do things first.
Absolutely. And within there, there's probably a core question that needs to be answered for every level, and it's not that the core message has to answer this, but everyone's going to be asking, what's in it for me? What does this mean for me, right? And you mentioned there that the first reports that we've had out of, there's something happening in Wuhan, we've never seen it before, it could do this. And I guess for me, I was looking at going, great, we've recently come through another Ebola pandemic in Africa, we've seen SARS, we've seen MERS, we've seen pandemics in regional areas. What's in it for me? Well, none of those impacted me, so why would this one impact me? And as the messages evolve, obviously that those questions keep coming into it. What does this mean for me? What does this mean for me? And my response was able to change. But that's a core question that everyone, either consciously or subconsciously, is dealing with during change, aren't they? What does this mean for me? What impact will this have?
Absolutely. In our terms, the with-em, the what's in it for me, because that's how common that question is when you're going through change. And again, it comes back to, we're all humans, and people tend to think in a few different ways. They think about what's in it for me from a personal perspective, from a people around them perspective, and then because I'm always thinking about organizational change, what it means for their organization too. So you start with, what's in it for me personally? What are the things I'm going to have, such as, I'm going to stay alive, I'm going to be healthy, I'm not going to get myself in trouble with the police. What's in it for the people around me? Well, are there vulnerable people in my family? How do my actions help keep them safe? How do I make sure that at the end of this, they're in a position to be able to thrive? And then at an organisational level, and you could even roll this up to New Zealand if you wanted to, but at an organisational level, how does this make sure my organisation or my country is actually in a good position? How do I make sure that you know they're able to continue on doing what they do?
Absolutely. And I think there's the long-term embedding as well. One of the behaviours I expect we'll start to see a change from, of having managed people and having dealt with sick leave in the past, and or the reverse of people coming in when they really should take sick leave, I can see a change twofold in this. One, employers are probably going to be more open to not having someone in the office who's sick or unwell, because obviously the consequences, we've seen it already, what could happen. But secondly, employers are going to be more open to their staff working remotely, and people are going to be more open to taking their work remote as well. It's a twofold thing there. So what was previously the hero culture of, I've got a bit of a runny nose and a sniffle, but I'll still go to the office, and I'll try not to infect everyone, but haha, I did, sorry. That's actually going to be, oh, I'm not feeling so well, I'll make sure that I take my laptop home and I'll work from home for the next 3 days. And the boss is probably, if you're in the situation where that can work, the boss is probably going to say, great, you do that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And again, that comes back to our New Zealand psyche. We've always had that "she'll be right" attitude. And again, we have seen that manifest in people coming into work when they shouldn't, getting those around them sick. And it will be interesting as well to see how people then start to utilise things like their sick leave. But also how they utilise things like their annual leave to take care of themselves and stay healthy. Because and I'm speaking from quite a privileged position to be able to do this, but you know, those of us who take a holiday on a, you know, on an annual basis overseas, that's not going to happen. And quite often we'd save up our annual leave because it's such a trek to get to other parts of the world. So actually being in lockdown in New Zealand or having closed borders, does that now mean that instead we might be more open to doing, you know, a week here and a week there and taking more regular breaks and in general take better care of our wellness? So it really starts changing the fundamental way that we behave and how we consider how we take care of ourselves and take more seriously that we need to take care of ourselves and not get run down.
And therein lies part of the value of a good change management process, right, isn't it? It's helping people embed those behaviours in. That they can actually become habitual and become part of their DNA.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting, right? Because you made the comment earlier about people being more open to flexible working and other such things. I think one of the things that's been really interesting, and I'm seeing it because I'm back in my office at the moment, but the majority of our office, you know, because we're recording this during level two, so the majority of our people are still working from home or maybe only coming in one day a week with very strict protocols. Interestingly, we where I work, we moved to Teams. We very rapidly moved to Teams, might I add, prior to lockdown, and people have embraced the technology. But one, they've embraced the parts of the technology they know. So there's a piece around it. We're using it as effectively as we can. But secondly, being back in the office and having a lot of people still working remotely, it also changes the way that we need to manage dynamics. So working at home when everyone else is working at home is very different to working at home when some people are working at home and some people are in the office. So how does that change the way we work when we come into our buildings and we interact? Just this week, we've seen a lot of people in the office taking up whole meeting rooms for just one person because they're on a Teams call, and a good number of their teammates are working at home. But then there's another person in the office on the same Teams call who potentially is sitting at their desk with headphones in or potentially is in another meeting room because they're trying to maintain social distancing. So there's a lot of protocols that we actually need to be thinking about and you know, meeting etiquette and how does that work, and it will be different to what it was in level four and level three, but I don't think we're as prepared for that as we should be because we're only starting to see these things as people come back in.
Correct. And I was talking with someone earlier today who works for one of the telcos, and the point they raised was that when you're in the office, when everyone's in there together, there was a 5-minute conversation, you know, Christy's at a desk, I'll go and have a chat with her about that thing. 5 minutes, done, dusted. Working remotely, working, let's call it invisibly, because you can't see the other person. Those 5-minute value add conversations disappear, and suddenly you've got a half hour meeting booked in the calendar or a 15-minute meeting booked in the calendar, and you're juggling all these priorities because you've gone away from that. Well, I saw Christy, I could see Christy, so I'll go and talk to her and she's not on the phone.
That's it. And the other thing, so it's the accidental bump-in. And you get so much value from those accidental bump-ins because they are those quick 2-minute conversations. Whereas if you're on Teams, you'll go, oh, I don't want to disturb them. Oh, they're on busy. You know, I probably shouldn't give them a quick ring. Whereas if someone is just over the pod from you, you can say, hey, have you got a minute, or can I get your eyes over this? There are those really cool interaction points, and it's how one, can we replicate those virtually? But two, what are the ones that we can't replicate virtually? And how do we start thinking of the office as the place where we come to collaborate, the place where we come to connect? And think about working from home as another flexible working option, but not just as a black and white, you're either in the office or you're at home. We have to be thinking about this in a holistic sense. And that's going to be a big behaviour change piece, because people are currently in that mode of I'm at home or I'm at work. We need to be going, actually, what are the different options that come through there?
Absolutely. And what are the barriers that I'm going to have to overcome, but also what are the barriers I need to put up to set those set the constructions or constraints that I want to work in? It's not saying that people have to go into a silo, but certainly when I'm at home, how do I make sure that I embed good behaviour?
Yes. And it's even little things. I'm not sure if you observed that, Anne, but I found being at home, my diary was basically a full day of Teams meetings. And at least if you're physically in a room, if you need to do something like nip to the bathroom or get a cup of tea, there's physical presence where you can say, I'm just going to step out for a second. Doing that on Teams, you know, you've got the chat function, but it's a slightly different experience. And I know just from talking to lots of different people, the fatigue is quite different. You know, if you're on a screen all day, how does that affect you? So it's a whole new way of working that we've adopted rapidly, and a lot of organisations are saying, you know, why didn't we do this sooner? This was so easy. Actually, we were forced into a situation, and there are good things that have come from it, but there are also bad, and we need to work out what we want to retain, but also what's actually not a good thing to be retaining, or what's something that's a needs must only.
Yeah. On saying that, though, there's one behaviour that I've come across recently through all of this, which is good, and hopefully this has changed for the good. In a previous life, I spent a lot of time on conference calls where I was at the remote end, and when you're the only person dialed into a meeting where everyone else is in the same room and you're trying to break into that conversation, it can be hard, and there's meeting etiquette that needs to be followed. If the people in the room aren't following, it's very hard to get your 5 cents in. What I've noticed with Zoom calls and with Teams calls, people are actually starting to build in that pause. They're starting to accept that as other people are around and people need to think and engage in different ways, those pauses and those behaviours have been built in. So conferencing etiquette is actually becoming a little bit more ingrained in people.
It is, but it isn't. And again, I think I say that being fortunate enough to have been back in the office, but being on calls where people aren't. And it's quite fascinating. I was actually in a meeting today where we had some of us in one room, some of us in another, and then probably another third of the group virtual. And what's interesting is that the room that had the more dominant speakers did revert back to some of those old behaviours. So it's about how do you embed those behaviours, but how do you embed them in a blended way? Because again, if everyone's on Zoom or everyone's on Teams, you can use the hand raise function. And the chair of the meeting has that illustrious mute all power. I actually asked for that in a meeting room today. I really wanted to have the mute all power. And if someone can grant me that, I would be just over the moon. But we don't have those options. So how do we embed those practices? And one of the key things is about how do we role model those with our leaders? You know, one of the key tenets of change is people will take their director from, you know, their executive leaders or their line manager. So there's a leadership piece there too in terms of what role modeling of behaviours is going to happen. And there's also an effective cheering piece. So how do we just make that standard business practice? No matter what you do, how do you help people to cheer across multiple dimensions?
And you're right in there. It's standard meeting etiquette as well. You know, even in a group meeting where everyone's in the same place, there are different. Everyone's got a different level of EQ. They've got a different way they process and engage and think. You do have to make sure that the person who's quietly sitting in the corner mulling everything over is included and feels that they're included as well.
I've seen something really, really cool of late. I've seen someone do a couple of really cool tricks in their cheering. So this person, it's a regular group that meets, and she's very familiar with who are the more extroverted characters on the call and who are the less extroverted. And she'll actually listen out for who hasn't spoken, and she'll invite those people to speak by name at the end. Now, the people on this call are at a senior enough level that even if they are true introverts, they are prepared to have those conversations. But it's been quite interesting just watching that, because it's helped others to recognise that, yes, they are in the louder majority. And while we want everyone to be themselves and we want everyone to have the opportunity to share, we also need to make sure we're creating that space for those who do want that reflective time, or actually, you know, respond in different ways to still feel that they can do so. And I say that as a raving introvert. It's really nice to see some of that reflection being balanced in and to also help people recognize that silences are actually an important thing, and giving people space to speak. It's not an invitation for everyone who can't handle an awkward silence to start speaking. It's actually about turning it into an opportunity for reflection and letting quieter voices take a moment.
Absolutely. And if you want a great example of silence, I think the Canadian Prime Minister, just taking it back to politics for a moment, the Canadian Prime Minister provided that earlier this week when he took 21 seconds of silence before he answered a question that the media put to him. I thought it was incredible because so many people would have tried to fill that gap and probably run their mouth off. And he's a world leader putting a significant amount of thought into how he's going to phrase that answer so he doesn't upset another world leader as a result of what he says.
I like that. I like that. And again, and I'll bring us back to change because I noticed that, you know, you said we won't go to politics and here you are, as expected, getting some good political nerdiness. I love it. Absolutely love it. But I think if you bring it back to change, one of the things we're focused on is, you know, we have to make sure we've got really good and clear messages, but everything we say matters. And One of the first things I teach my change managers when they first start in the role, and this is my theory, and I'm very, very happy to be challenged, but every change manager has a favourite tool, and mine is the impacts analysis. It's, you know, it's a delightful thing because it's where you get into some detail, but it's never the big things that catch you up. It's always the little things that catch you up. The thing that you say that people take the wrong way, or the little thing that you don't really think about until it really kicks you. And you know, taking that 21 seconds to answer a question, it is about understanding that if I get this wrong, I can't walk this back. I can't undo this. And it's okay as a leader to actually pause for a moment and say, to think, or even as a leader to pause and say, I don't know. I will get you the answer, but I don't know. And I'm not going to stand here and make something up. I'm actually going to make sure I give you the right information. And look, we've seen that in the media briefings that the Prime Minister and Dr. Ashley Bloomfield were doing. It was about factual information getting that went out to the New Zealand public as official channels, and actually calling out where there was incorrect information. We've got to get these things right, because if we don't and we get them wrong on a big platform, it's so hard to walk that back.
And particularly in this day and age with social media, where everyone's got an opinion and everyone's got a platform to voice that opinion, there was plenty of examples that I've seen, not just over the last 8 weeks, but over the last 8 years or longer, where social media has put out, or social media has been used as a platform to put out incorrect viewpoints and incorrect opinions that are contrary. And it was happening just as much through this as well. The Prime Minister and the Director General of Health were putting out factual statements, whereas social media, there were people that were contradicting that. And it's very hard to build a balanced message around that, isn't it?
It is. And okay, I'm going to take us to politics now. I'm sorry. If we look at what's happened in the US, I mentioned before that people take their cues, their key direction from their executive leaders and from their direct line managers. And if we look at what the American president has been stating, I actually was having a conversation with a rheumatologist a few weeks ago, and we were chatting away about some of the things that the American president had said and how they caused genuine supply chain impacts because he referenced a certain type of medication. There are people who genuinely need that, and because of one sentence that's been said, probably with no thought or very interesting thought put into it, it's caused real supply chain issues. And then we also have, you know, incidents like the bleach incident, where you just go, do you not understand that you are putting out these directives that are wrong and that actually people are going to take their cue from it? This is where you get into the importance of effective leadership in times of change. And we've seen so many stories and articles coming out about the different leadership styles coming out internationally and how that, you know, what that has actually meant for countries that are trying to actually eliminate COVID-19 in their environment.
And keep their people safe at the same time as well, I think, because those two outcomes are mutually exclusive. Keeping your people safe and eliminating COVID-19, they have two very clear outcomes to them, but they don't necessarily mean the same thing.
I think that you actually make an incredible point to that, because you're absolutely spot on. And you think about some of the original schools of thought that came out about herd mentality. That in itself is such an example of where these things don't stack up. And it's about that holistic picture. And again, change management, you always need to be thinking about the outcome. It's not the solution. It's not the fix. It's the outcome. What's the outcome you're trying to achieve by doing this? And that's where you can take a broader view and understand that I could do this thing here and it fits fixes this one part of the outcome or this one output potentially that I want to achieve, but does that get me to where I ultimately want to be with that overall outcome?
Definitely. And that's where there's overlaps between change management and other competencies like enterprise architecture, something I'm quite familiar with, incident management within technology, incident management outside of technology. What's the outcome you're trying to achieve? What's the problem you're trying to solve that we're going through here? And it's why an effective team of or an effective organization doesn't try and build all that competency into one area. You know, change that goes best is when the enterprise architect's addressing why the change is happening, what needs to happen from a technical and a strategic perspective, but a change manager sitting there going, great, now we're going to take all that technical jargon, we're going to throw it in the bin, and we're going to turn it into a message that the people that need to understand will get.
I feel like we've worked together before, eh?
Maybe we did.
And I mean, you know, you can also look at things like Simon Sinek's model of start with why. So actually, why are we doing this? And again, if you've got that why right, if you help people understand that this is actually what we're doing, sorry, what's behind it, then you can move into the how and then eventually into the what. And yep. Unfortunately, what we tend to see is people start with the what, then the how, then the why. You've got to get your why right. Because if that understanding is there, then people are more accepting of how we're going to do it and then what we actually need to do.
Definitely. And in an earlier episode where I talked with Etna Sweeney about communication through different events, she touched on something very similar as well. And we talked about helping people understand the core behind something. So even something as simple as we're changing buildings. We're moving from building X to building Y. It's very simple for rumor to spread as to why that change is happening and what the impact of it's going to be. But the reality could be quite simple. It could be the company's too big and we can't fit here anymore. It could be the building's no longer fit for use or fit for purpose. It could be a number of factors, but if you don't start with that very clear why, the message could become, oh, the company's in trouble, we can't afford the rent, oh, we're doing this, oh, we're doing that, oh, they're going to try and cut jobs, but they don't want to make us redundant, so we'll quit because we don't want to travel to there. It's like, no, it's a very simple change that we're going through, but because we didn't give you the why up front, you've gone and made up your own assumptions, and suddenly the change barrier is amplified significantly.
And it also comes back to, again, solution versus outcome. So one of the things that's always concerning is when someone comes to you and says, right, we're going to do this thing. I found a shiny magpie and that's what we're going to chase. The solution's predetermined and they go through through an artificial options process to basically get them to that point of saying, yes, this is the right solution, tra-la-la-la-la. Again, bring it back to it's what you're saying, problem definition. What's the problem we're trying to solve? Start with a solution. People are smart. People will see through a fake argument. If you're genuine about the problem and you communicate it articulately and openly and honestly, and you look at this as the outcome we're trying to get to, people buy into that. They don't buy into things that feel like spin, and we can't spin. It's that simple.
You can't spin, and you can start the message a lot earlier than where you've got the solution as well. So using that, we're moving buildings as an example. You could quite early start the conversation of, it's becoming clear to us that this building is no longer big enough to sustain the organization. So suddenly, 2 or 3 months down the track, when you've found a new location, 1 plus 1 is 5. Everyone's suddenly going, great. I remember when you said it wasn't fit for purpose. We've been quite clear about that narrative all the way through. Now you've gone and found another one. I'm going to focus on what this means for me as opposed to why are we moving? I like my desk here.
Yeah, there's a line I'm going to use, and it's a line by an absolutely amazing former leader I had, a woman named Barbara Horn, and anyone who's worked with me before has heard me harp on about this to the point that I think most of my team here have adopted it. But it's along the lines of, if you can't give certainty, give clarity. And it's about, you know, we won't always have the answers, but if we can give clarity, then people will accept that. So a perfect example is, COVID-19. When are we going to move to alert level 1? We don't know that. But the clarity is, when we make a decision on this date, the clarity is, this is what level 1 will look like. So if you don't, again, it comes back to, there's always a piece of clarity you can give. Even if that clarity is just, this is when we will next update you. You've got to stick to that update date. You can't step away from that because then you'll lose buy-in and credibility. But give that clarity, and that will help people sort of fill that void until you can get to a point.
Yeah, and definitely seeing that pan out through level 2, level 3, and level 2, was quite clear as well. You know, the announcement that we're moving to level three, and leading into that, it was very clear on what level three meant. There was the line of it's like level four, but with KFC, but it was still very clear. It was still very clear what it meant to the public as well. So it was understood. But as soon as we hit level three, you started to hear the questions, well, what does level two look like? What does level two look like? And the message was still, well, we haven't worked that out yet, but we'll tell you on this date and you will know. So there was no point in trying to second guess what level two was going to be, because we would know on the date that we were going to be told. And that's always been quite consistent.
It has, although I will note that certainly we've had all sorts of media and commentators certainly speculating as we go. That's when you say, well, what you can also say is speculation a helpful thing? Sometimes it is, in terms of softening the ground, and that's another trick of the trade. Sometimes you can give some information early that helps to soften the ground or lessen some of the nervousness around that uncertainty. But when that speculation is just taking it so far down the wrong direction, that's when you have to say, well, how do we manage this? How do you make sure that you're really clear on where those official sources of information are going to come from, and how do you make sure you wrap support around people to be able to make good judgment calls about where they should be listening to things?
Absolutely, and we're seeing the same thing in Auckland happen at the moment as well. We've got the double-edged sword of not only are we dealing with a major health crisis, but we've also dealing with a significant infrastructure problem in the fact that we don't have enough water in the dams because it hasn't rained enough in Auckland. Anyone who knows Auckland will know that this is bizarre that it hasn't rained enough here.
Taking my umbrella to Auckland every time I travelled there. It is strange.
Funnily enough, it's raining as we talk, but it's still not going to be enough. But again, we're being softened. We're being fed enough information early on that we can build some certainty as to what it means. You know, it's been very clear that you can't wash your car, you can't water blast. The questions of, well, can we still have a bath? Well, we're not actually setting any rules about what you can do inside the house, but outside the house, you can't water blast, you can't wash your car, which... Yeah. Led me down the wildly speculative path of, if I could figure out how to get my car inside my house, I could wash my car in my house. But no one's going to do that.
Before I mentioned the David Rock model before, the scarf model. This is where I'd say, so if you were washing your car in your driveway, as an example, then that primitive response around fairness would start to kick in. So one of the things, we come back to how we've managed COVID-19 with the different alert levels. I go back to the rates that we saw of people reporting other people for not following the rules. And New Zealanders in particular have a very strong sense of fairness. You know, things should be fair, things should be right, they should be equitable. So there's also part of me that says, you know, how much have we actually tapped into some of that psyche to help manage that, knowing that we will police ourselves in these moments if we see things that seem unfair. So even if you car into the house, I would caution you not to just have the sense that people will not see that as fair.
No, absolutely. And you're right. And I can't remember who I spoke to about this, but a friend of mine who is British talked about that sense of fairness as well. He said, you know, if you're in Britain and you talk about fairness, they've had centuries of class rule, class structure. So when you say to someone, that's not fair, they go, of course it's not fair, but I wasn't born in that neighbourhood, or I didn't go to that school or whatever, so that's life. But he said it's very different in New Zealand. If you want to get people power behind something, you just have to say, that's not fair. And as soon as you say that's not fair, Kiwis go, you're damn right that's not fair, and we're going to do something about it.
Yep, Kevin Milne, he was on something with fair go.
Oh, yeah, he definitely was. So I just want to come back to the scarf model, because there's two bits in there that I am interested in, status and authority. What's meant by those, and are they almost synonymous? Are they actually meaning two different perspectives?
So I'll actually start, it's status and autonomy, rather than authority.
Sorry, I heard it wrong.
That's okay. But it is interesting, because status is, and I can actually bring status back to our point around fairness, because they almost seem that they could be in contradiction with one another, because status is about our relative importance to one another. It's the posturing and the peacocking that we do when we're in a situation where we want to demonstrate that we have mana, we have status in this. And it's also that loss of status as well. You know, what happens if you lose it? How does that push you back into a very reactive mode? Autonomy is coming back to that sense of control, though. So how are we, you know, do we feel like we're in control? Which a lot of us haven't felt that way through the COVID levels. But it would be a very good question to be asking if it was status and authority. I'd be saying, hang on a second, I have the exact same as you.
It's good, though, because it has helped clarify them. And you talked about mana and fairness and there was status, and I think that's it. Is again, coming back to it, we defined, it was very clearly defined from the start who had status to be out. And by that, mm-hmm. I'm meaning the essential workers. You know, mm-hmm. people were allowed out because they needed to be because of their job. But for everyone else, you're all treated equal. You may be the CEO of a bank that turns $1 billion profit, or you could be a retiree, or you could be on the disability benefit. The same rules apply. Stay home, yeah. Save lives. You know, it was the ones that were elevated into a position of status were the ones that were necessary to do so as a result.
And interestingly, if you look at some of our elected officials, not just here but abroad, who were caught out not following the rules, the level of backlash that they received was on a whole new level, because it comes back to, you know, it's that status piece of we are making sure that we're being very clear about who has the ability to do what. But again, it's also that fairness. If the rest of us are not doing these things, then what gives you the authority to act in a different way? And it's been interesting to see a very similar reaction across a multitude of nations. So it is fundamentally about how we work as humans. Fairness, yes, certainly we see a lot more of that across New Zealanders in the way that we work. But it has been fascinating just to watch very similar reactions play out.
Definitely. One final question, and I've got another one that I end on as well, but one final question, something that I picked up early on from another colleague of ours, a mutual colleague of ours, talking through change. She often said, or she talked through seven steps, and she said the most important step, and it probably it's superseded by start with why. I think start with why is still important. What she said to help people through is to actually explain to them what's not changing as a result, and make them understand that, using that building example, that building move example, when we move buildings, you will still come to work, you will still sit at your desk, you will still receive emails, you'll still take phone calls, you'll still do your job. How important do you feel that question is to, or that statement helping people?
It's absolutely critical, and it's something I think, and again, as a change manager, I think it's just so inherent in how we think. It's one of the first things that we do when we're thinking about what's our strategy for helping people through change, because certainly what I've found is working particularly with senior and executive level leaders, there's always a focus on what's changing. And one of the questions that you should always bring them back to is, but what's not changing? You will still be able to make a cup of tea. You will still, if you take a building move as an example, yes, the bus stop that you get off the bus at is changing, but the bus stop that you get on the bus at, when you leave your house, is staying the same. So you always want to be pointing out that not everything is changing, that actually a lot of things are staying the same.
Absolutely. And staying the same and by and large will continue to do so for a period of time. I think that's the important bit. It just helps people deal with what's important and what's necessary as opposed to deal with the trivial, I think.
Yeah, you're also, however, giving them an anchor or a reference point as well. By saying what stays the same, you're giving them a sense of the comfort of the familiar and the comfortable. And it just helps reinforce that not everything is shifting. And it's important that people get that sense that we aren't, and again, building move example is really good, because I remember doing a building move some time ago, and one of the things that we were talking about with a few of the staff who were a little bit resistant to the change was, trying to understand what had happened when they moved house in their personal life. What was that process look like? Trying to give them a point of commonality. But again, being able to talk about what stayed the same, which was, you still wear the same shoes. You still get up at a similar time, unless maybe you've moved suburbs and that's quite drastic. But, try again, as that reference point, to try and give them a sense of the comfortable.
Yeah. I remember down to the point of back in the BNZ days during one of the Wellington earthquakes, where there was a lot of concern about what was going to happen to the cafe that was in the building that we were no longer able to get into, and were the cafe workers still going to be okay, and could we get their coffee from anywhere? I remember that being a frequent conversation. I won't say it was a core concern, but a frequent conversation.
I remember that one too, and it was one where it was nice in the sense that you could see the humanity coming through, actually caring about others, and checking after their well-being, because for people listening to this, it was a building that was, you know, a little bit of a walk from the CBD. It was the place to get coffee without having to walk a good 10 to 15 minutes. So you got to know the baristas, you got to know the staff. So it was really nice to actually see that sense of human coming back, that people genuinely cared about those that they saw in the building who were directly employed by the organisation, but were still part of your everyday interactions.
Definitely, definitely. Mm-hmm. Look, Christy, it's been fantastic to catch up, and some really good things to look into. I'm going to be posting a few links as part of this around the SCARF model you talked about, and you talked about AdCare as well. You're the second person this week to have brought that one up in a conversation, so either I'm hanging out with too many change managers or it's a topic at the moment.
I don't think you're hanging out with too many change managers, by the way. And I think you've just found, I think you've found your tribe.
Well, that's it. We talked about before the value of having someone who can translate all of the jargon that an EA would bring to the table and put it into common speak. So as a reforming enterprise architect, I definitely get the value of having someone who can translate it for me.
Excellent. Excellent. The mission is complete.
Yep. Hey, so I just want to finish with a slightly different focus. It's a question that I've been putting to everyone through the series. What are you reading that's helping shape your thinking or helping guide the approach you take to work, to doing what you do?
So this is really a really interesting question, because to be honest, what I'm reading at the moment is it's shaping, but it's not shaping. I'm reading a book, and I'll need to double check the title so that you can post the link. But I believe the correct title is The Failure of Risk Management. And anyone who knows me well will probably laugh at hearing that. But it's one of the best risk management reads I've seen, because it's all about very practical examples of things that have happened and some of those key risk failure points. Interestingly, though, the key takeout that I've been taking from that is how do you really see risk management as an opportunity, as a strategic lever? And if I think again about our current situation, some of the things we're seeing in terms of risks, how do they actually become our strategic opportunities? How do we take them further forward? So I've been reading that. I think that's the only big one. And I have been reading cookbooks, but I feel like that's a bit of a lockdown hangover from spending so much time at home.
I think a lot of people have probably been, their reading choices have been varied and diverse over the last few months, because what else can you do? There was only so much Netflix.
There is one other one as well. Sorry, I should have mentioned it. I should have mentioned it because it's right there on the coffee table at home. It's a book by a woman named Alicia Mackay, and it's called It's a Guide to Getting Shit Done in the Public Sector. That is the title of the book. And it's we're in the organisation where I am at the moment. We're looking at our strategy. We're looking at how we do investment. Some of those really, really cool, engaging, challenging conversations to be involved. But I like it because it's a very simple but strategic approach to how we want to work. So that's the other thing I've been reading.
Nice. I'm going to have to dig out the risk management one for my reading as well. I'm giving a presentation at a risk management conference in a few months, and I feel, given the topic is how to embed a risk management culture, I feel that this is probably going to help me with that.
I think it might. There's definitely some handy wee examples that you could weave in there.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, Christy, look, it's been really great catching up. It's been a really good conversation. So thank you so much for your time. And thank you for sacrificing a little bit of your Friday evening as well.
Oh, like for you and any time.
Awesome. Hey, look, we'll end there. Thank you very much. And all those links that we talked about and some of those concepts, they'll be in the description here as well for everyone else as well. So thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to BizBytes, brought to you by The IT Psychiatrist. Check out our blog at www.theitpsychiatrist.co.nz/blog for bonus material and more information.